This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lines that Iranian foreign minister dismisses as, quote, absurd nonsense, a claim by France that Tehran is in the process of building up nuclear weapons. Former FBI Director James Comey warns of what he calls a very serious risk of violence at the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden next week. And Dutch riot police use water cannons to disperse a protest in Amsterdam against the national coronavirus lockdown. Hello and welcome to our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister comes down hard on his French counterpart after he accused the Islamic Republic of building up a nuclear weapons capacity. Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed Jean-Yves Le Drian's claim as absurd nonsense. He accused France of destabilizing the West Asian region by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. Zarif said, quote, Saudi war criminals use French weapons to slaughter children in Yemen. The French foreign minister made these comments in an interview published on Saturday. That came less than 2 weeks after Iran enriched uranium at higher levels. France has accused Iran of breaching the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran says the enrichment is in response to non-compliance by European signatories to the deal. To discuss that more, we're joined by Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, who's joining us from London. Thank you very much, Mr. Corrigan. If you could please tell us what your take is on these accusations coming from the part of France. We do know that Iran has time and again warned that it will reduce its level of commitment to the JCPOA if the other signatories do not comply.
Well, Iran is correct. They have been the only country that has been complying with the JCPOA. Britain, France, and Germany give lip service to it, but have really done nothing to hold up their end of the bargain. And of course, the United States withdrew from the agreement and has, you know, tightened up the sanction regime against the country, which is the whole point of having Iran to get some economic benefit by the reduction of sanctions. But it's really hypocritical. In France, the government is sort of attacking and harassing Muslims, and is stirring up that, so it's an age-old strategy. You want to blame some religious group for the problems in the country and distract them. The Nazis did that in Germany. You know, other countries have done that. The French are doing it now against the Islamic community. Iran has the right under Article 26 and 36 to take measured steps if the other countries are not in compliance, and the European countries and the Americans are not in compliance. It also is hypocritical, the fact that France is selling arms to Saudi Arabia, which are being used against civilians in Yemen, and that's a terrible thing. And of course, Iran is surrounded by nuclear powers. You know, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, India has nuclear weapons, you know, the British, the French, the Americans, and the Israelis. The Israelis have nuclear weapons, maybe as many as 400. So what the real game plan is to keep Iran, so it's not capable of defending itself, and therefore it can be pressured by the Western powers in terms of its support for, Hezbollah, its support for the government in Syria. And I'm not aware of any direct support from Iran to the rebels or the government in Yemen, but that is certainly within Iran's prerogative. The United States is, I guess, like 162 countries or something that they have military bases in, and they're, want to control the world and make sure that nobody else can get up, and they're standing on the neck of all these countries, which of course leads to all sorts of problems. The International Atomic Energy Agency has concurred that Iran is not producing nuclear weapons. Ayatollah Khomeini said that Iran is not going to pursue nuclear weapons because it's un-Islamic. And Iran also has not attacked another country for nearly 300 years. But the Israelis attack actually probably on a weekly basis. They're violating Lebanese airspace, or they're bombing Syria, occupying land in Lebanon, Syria, even Jordan, and of course Palestinian territories in the West Bank and Gaza. So, you know, it really is hypocritical. There's a political agenda going on here which deals with domestic politics in France. And the French are closing down mosques, they're attacking people, they're running sort of a thinly veiled hate campaign against the Muslim community in France. So, you know, Iran is perfectly correct from a logical, from a rational point of view. And quite frankly, if France and Britain and other countries have nuclear weapons, Iran is entitled to be able to protect itself as well. But Iran, there's no evidence that they're producing nuclear weapons. They're just taking small steps. They've enriching uranium up to the 20% level. But there's no evidence whatsoever, other than some cheap propagandistic attempts by Israel and the United States to blame Iran, saying it's trying to make nuclear weapons. But quite frankly, there's nothing wrong with that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from Ontario. And Iran says its logical and rational demand is that U.S. sanctions against the country be lifted. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran underlined whether or not Washington will return to the Iran nuclear deal is of no concern to Tehran. Rather, he added that the lifting of sanctions is what matters. Ali Akbar Sadeh, he noted that the most important sanctions are the ones imposed on Iran's banking and oil sectors. He stressed that Tehran will accept no preconditions for the United States' return to the agreement. The United States unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear accord in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions that were lifted under the agreement. Israel has advanced plans for 780 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. That is what an Israeli settlement watchdog group says. According to Peace Now, most of the planned settler units will be built deep in the West Bank. The plan was ordered by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week. Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law, but Tel Aviv has been expanding them in the past years. Israel even stepped up the settlement construction under the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. He strongly backed the projects. The U.N. Security Council has in the past several years approved resolutions calling for the halt to the Israeli settlements. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, joined us earlier to give us an update on the latest Israeli plans for hundreds of new settler units.
Last week, Israel approved 800 settler units in the occupied West Bank. Today, Netanyahu's regime has approved 780 new settler units deep inside the settlements, deep inside the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian presidency issued a statement condemning the new plan and considered that settlements in general and the ongoing settler activity destroys any chance to achieve comprehensive peace and end occupation and build the Palestinian state. The Palestinian presidency called on the international community to interfere and force Israel to stop settlement activities. Now, we are speaking about the new 800 units, according to the Israeli, to the anti-settlement monitoring group. Israel approved 12,000 settler units only in 2020. It's the highest number in a single year since it began recording statistics in 2012. Israel also approved the plans for over 27,000 settler units in the 4 years term of Trump administration.
Former FBI Director James Comey has warned of a very serious risk of violence at the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden next Wednesday. Comey said there are armed distributed people that police need to take seriously ahead of the event at the Capitol. U.S. intelligence reports show authorities are tracking thousands of threats against politicians. The online threats include calls for assassinating Democrat lawmakers. There are also calls for building improvised explosive devices and using sniper rifles to kill law enforcement officers. That has prompted security forces to gear up for a series of demonstrations and potential violence across the country. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump have planned a million militia march in Washington on Biden's inauguration day. Guatemalan security forces have used sticks and tear gas to repel a large caravan of Honduran migrants bound for the United States. The clashes happened after hundreds of migrants pressed into walls of security forces across the country. Authorities said an unspecified number of people have been injured during the unrest. Over 7,000 migrants have entered Guatemala since Friday, facing off with around 3,000 Guatemalan security officials. Honduran migrants flee poverty and violence in a country hammered by the coronavirus pandemic and back-to-back hurricanes. Guatemala has so far sent back almost 1,000 migrants. The caravan tries to advance towards Mexico and then walk into the U.S. Meanwhile, demonstrators and police have clashed in the Dutch capital, Amsterdam, during protests against the national lockdown to slow the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. Riot police used water cannons and tear gas to disperse the crowd, who threw fireworks at security forces. The protesters were carrying signs reading, "Freedom, stop the siege." None of the demonstrators were wearing masks, and few respected social distancing rules. The Netherlands government closed schools and most shops in December to try to stem a surge in COVID-19 cases, and this week extended the lockdown by at least another 20 days. In Uganda, political tensions remain high following the presidential election that saw the incumbent president extend his decades-long rule. Opposition leader Bobi Wine has rejected the result. His party says that he has remained under house arrest since the Thursday vote. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the developments with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine is reportedly under house arrest after disputed presidential election. Wine's party, the National Unity Platform, says police have surrounded his home. However, officials say police are providing security and protection for him. Meanwhile, Wine has pledged to legally contest the results of Thursday's election and urged supporters to refrain from violence. While the vote saw incumbent President Yoweri Museveni secure his sixth term in office. According to Uganda's Electoral Commission, Museveni won 59% of the vote. Wine has accused him of fabricating the results. He's called the poll the most fraudulent election in Uganda's history. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Abayomi Azakiwi, editor Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit, and Julius Mobanlatu, Africa affairs expert and political analyst out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Detroit. What's your take, Abayomi, on what is happening in Uganda? On the one hand, the current president basically is saying that he has won fair and square, and of course the opposition is accusing him of fraud.
Museveni has been in power since 1986. He didn't come to power through the ballot box. He came through force of arms due to the political chaos and contradictions that have existed, that did exist in Uganda, beginning in the 1970s through the mid-1980s. And people do credit him for stabilizing the country politically and socially, as well as economically. Nonetheless, it's hard to gauge whether or not the allegations of Bobi Wine are accurate. In terms of whether or not he actually won the elections. The European Union seems to suggest that the elections were a reflection of the political sentiment in the country. Nonetheless, perhaps there needs to be some review of what actually happened, but who's going to carry out that review? And at the same time, what is the alternative program to the national resistance movement coming from this leading opposition candidate?
Mm. Julius, your take on where the situation is going in Uganda. We know that Bobby Wine now is under house arrest. Do you see the situation calming soon, or do you think it could get worse?
I want to say that Museveni never changes the script. The script is always the same. We have seen before his contender, oppositionist Kizza Besigye, previously going through the same thing that Bobi Wine has gone through. We've seen before, prior to the election date, during when his contender was Kizza Besigye, we've seen him being arrested, supporters being arrested before the election. So there's nothing new, definitely nothing new. We've seen, you know, Kizza Besigye having fought him before, being disoriented by this kind of tactics Museveni uses, using the military and also excuses of he's protecting the presidential candidate, actually when he's restricting their movement. What Bobi Wine is going through right now, Kizza Besigye has gone through, but actually Bobi Wine has gone through worse. We saw before the election the violence meted by the security forces on Bobi Wine's, you know, like supporters, and also Bobi Wine supporters being arrested at the same time. Now, election is over, and to the credit of Ugandans, it was pretty peaceful. But of what use is a peaceful election whereby citizens have really gone through to withstand long queues and the pain of waiting, yet there's no transparency? You see, in proper elections, number one, opposition leaders don't go through arrest before the election date like we've seen in Uganda for a very long time during Museveni's reign. And also during the election day, every opposition party, every party is represented on the ballot. So when everything is being counted, they all agree and they sign collectively. All leaders vying for position, I mean political party leaders, they agree on the results. But in this case, you have a country, internet shut down. And at the same time, you ask yourself, even how did the Electoral Commission transmit their results from the villages, from the local levels to the national, without internet? How was it possible? So the lack of transparency, the use of military to contain opposition is a disaster for Uganda. And actually, when you look into also Museveni's mind, Museveni, you can never challenge him. You say, oh, 40 years is too much, you know, long for one president to be in power. Then you tell you, oh, look at UK, there's no presidential limit. Look at the US, there's no presidential limit. That's what he always says, excuses. But this is Africa. You know, this is a republic. It's not a monarchy. And every child born in Uganda should have the right to vie for presidency. If one president stays 40 years in power, that's about four generations.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
Where the bone of contention comes in. In the future, I do think Bobi Wine faces challenge because the court system is still under the control of Museveni, and also at the moment is really restricted by the military.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us on this news review. Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor, Pan-African Newswire. Out of Detroit, and Julius Mabalatu, African affairs expert and political analyst out of London.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Alex Barsagian, CEO of a startup, RoboEats, which began in Latvia and is now headquartered in Canada, said automated kitchen technology has been gaining interest in recent years, and that has been accelerated by the coronavirus pandemic. RoboEats is launching its artificial intelligence-powered autonomous robotic kitchen system that prepares, cooks, and serves an array of hot and cold food dishes, from soups to salads to meal bowls. The robotic system, designed for food services operations in corporate offices, campuses, and hospitals, as well as quick-serve restaurants, takes over some of the tedious food prep tasks while improving food safety and eliminating infection risks from crowded kitchens. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Rob Lever and Julie James under the heading, Pandemic's Robot Heroes Highlight Their Value at Tech Show. This article was published by the France Press News Agency. Please stay to hear more. Robots that help people survive and stay safe over the past year are touting their value at the tech industry's annual extravaganza amid a pandemic, which has given fresh momentum to the robotic sector. The Consumer Electronics Show, CES, which is being held online this year due to the global crisis, includes robots that have become heroes for many during the coronavirus pandemic. Among those taking the virtual stage at CES are robot companies, cooks, delivery drones, medical assistants, and those handling the perilous task of sanitizing workplaces and medical facilities. Robot companies saw surging demand in recent months as pandemic lockdowns intensified problems of isolation, especially for people in senior living homes. Amid the strict virus lockdown in France, the companion robot, Cootie, became a star in senior facilities. Anthony Battelle, chief executive of Cootie, said, "The pandemic completely changed our business model," adding, "We had envisioned Cootie at people's homes, but today we are dealing with isolation on a collective level." The startup based in northern French city Robe delivered 30 robots for free to senior facilities during the lockdowns and used the experience to improve the technology and train its teams. Batel said, "Everything worked well. Every 2 weeks, we would deliver software updates, which had to be done remotely. It's like what Tesla does." Cootie, which combines elements of a telepresence robot with a small digital assistant, will be part of the show this year following its commercial launch in France and a marketing push in the United States. Cootie's head of U.S. operations, Richard Marshall, said the crisis has shown people need more than a smart assistant such as Google or Amazon Alexa. The robot was designed to allow family members to check in and also help people find activities such as yoga or Tai Chi classes, either in person or online. Marshall said the point of Cootie is to connect individuals to other people, adding, it is not an Alexa on wheels. Amazon Alexa, also known simply as Alexa, is a virtual assistant AI technology developed by Amazon, first used in the Amazon Echo Smart speakers developed by Amazon Lab 126. It is capable of voice interaction, music playback, making to-do lists, setting alarms, streaming podcasts, playing audiobooks, and providing weather, traffic, sports, and other real-time information such as news. Wendy Moyle, a professor at Australia's Griffith University who specializes in research on the elderly, said, studies have shown people may develop a strong relationship to companion robots. But Moyle said current technology for most robots is not sophisticated enough, and that many people are disappointed after a while. Robots have taken on a new role in workplace and in medical facilities in era of social distancing. Misty Robotics, which produces a robot platform open to outside developers, last year launched its own temperature screening app for workplaces and medical facilities, which also working with partners, which can make the robot a companion or digital assistant. Misty Robotics Chief Executive Tim Enwall said the pandemic has made it easier for people to view robots as non-threatening and as friends. Enwall told AFP, the elderly don't have contact, and the elderly are certainly very afraid of viruses that can come from contact, and there is loneliness and isolation. And while at it in an office environment, robots like Misty can become a virtual concert, which eliminates the need for risky person-to-person contact. He said, the robot at the front door can do that at the same basic triage in a way that's very familiar to a lot of people. Adding, it's friendly, it's interactive, it's enjoyable. Meanwhile, several exhibitors, including South Korean giant LG, will be showing a new line of disinfecting robots, which have been in demand during the pandemic. LG's autonomous robot, which uses ultraviolet light to disinfect high-touch, high-traffic areas, is being launched this year to U.S. hotels, schools, corporate offices, retail and restaurant operators, and transformation hubs such as airports and train stations. The companies are betting that demand for improved health and safety will continue even after the pandemic is continued. Alex Barsigian, CEO of a startup, RoboEats, which began in Latvia and is now headquartered in Canada, said automated kitchen technology has been gaining interest in recent years, and that has been accelerated by the pandemic. RoboEats is launching its artificial intelligence-powered autonomous robotic kitchen system that prepares, cooks, and serves an array of hot and cold food dishes, from soups to salads to meal bowls. The robotic system designed for food services operations in corporate offices, campuses, and hospitals, as well as quick-serve restaurants, takes over some of the tedious food prep tasks while improving food safety and eliminating infection risks from crowded kitchens. Barsagayan said the idea of robotic food prep, which can cut food waste and labor costs, has gained traction as a result of the pandemic. He said, for a lot of restaurants, efficiency is important, adding, every millimeter in the kitchen is measured. They didn't think about social distancing, so automating the kitchen really solves that problem. RoboEats plans to launch its own restaurant in Latvia this month as it markets its Turkey kitchen in North America. Even after the pandemic fades, Barsegian said he expects a continued focus on health and safety in kitchens, adding, "I don't think it will ever be the same again."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to. And with me in the studio are two experts, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali Alavian and Said Mohsen Naqvi. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Before anything, let's say salam to the experts over here. Said Mohsen, salam alaikum, brother, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Brother Alavian, salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome, brother. You know that 1 year have passed the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in a drone attack by the U.S. last year. And for the commemoration ceremony of this dear general of Iran, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, tried to dedicate this series of the program to the speeches and thoughts of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about General Soleimani. Now, regarding some of the main characteristics of General Qasem Soleimani in the eyes of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Supreme Leader of Iran calls Qasem Soleimani not only a national hero, but a hero for the whole Muslim Ummah, Brother Ali Alavian. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may most peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. In our previous session, actually, we have enumerated some of the features of the school of thought of Soleimani with reference to the words of the leader of the Islamic Ummah. We mentioned two of them, that is, his permanent love towards martyrdom, and we define what does martyrdom mean. Martyrdom does not mean ordinary death, that a person can be fond of it, but rather it is dying on the way of, in the way of God, which makes Allah happy to see one of his servants doing his duties and whatever has been assigned to him. Second, the leader of the Islamic Ummah said that the second feature of the school of thought of Suleiman is that he was a true and genuine learner and a student of the way of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi. The third, I wanted to mention the third, but before that, I'd like to focus on one of the other features which you just mentioned, that is in rallying the resistance forces and the resistance line. So that it became a code word for the, let's say, combatants and all the freedom seekers in the regions who want to stand in front of arrogance, universal arrogance. Since he did not mind whom he's supporting with regard to the faith or ideology or the beliefs of the people, he was helping the mankind and human beings. Actually, when he was helping and, let's say, was giving services to the Palestinians, he was sure that they are, for example, followers of another school of thought in Islam.
That's right.
And when he was helping the people of Mosul, the majority of the northern part of Iraq are Sunni brothers.
That's right.
So he did not mind that they are Sunnis and he is helping them, but he worked even for the mankind.
His actions against the ISIS in Iraq and Syria was not only beneficial for the Muslims, even for the, we can say, Izzadis of Iran.
Izzadis, yeah.
Yeah, who were over
Christians
there.
And
Christians
also.
And Izzadis over there who were not Muslims at all. They benefited from the bravery of Qasem Soleimani.
When he was going in this way, actually he showed, he became a role model for others in the region to find a way that in case you want to serve Islam, serve your maktab, your school of thought, that is the religion that you are following, this is the way that you have to go. You don't need to care that a person, this person is, for example, Shia or Sunni, because the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Man asbah wa lam yahtam bi umur al-muslimin falaysa bi muslim." He actually was a real, let's say, he understood this hadith of the Holy Prophet very beautifully and rightly, because he was helping different groups in the region.
That's right.
Majority of these groups, I can say, assure the respected listeners that majority of them were not exactly Shias. So actually, it shows something else, that that's those right. who created ISIS, as you mentioned rightly, Hillary Clinton mentioned in her book.
I mean, the U.S. choices, system, in fact, created
hard
choices ISIS.
That they created it.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to make some discrepancies among different sects of Islam.
Yes.
But this person understood the threat and understood the way to oppose them. So he went and actually rallied all different groups and made them stand in front of this global arrogance.
I think the main mastermind behind all the operations of Qasim Soleimani was Rahbar himself. This is a point that must not be forgotten. As a soldier of the Rahbar, he exactly did what his leader and his commander told him. He's the commander of chief of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. So I think the best mastermind was him. But in the operational field, Qasim Soleimani was the best man.
Look, you are very right, because he learned the basis and fundamentals from the leader.
Yeah.
When you learn Mabna or Mabani from a teacher, or the fundamentals, the basis, from a right teacher, then you act, even without him, you can act rightly as the leader himself.
That's
he
right.
was a good, let's say, pupil of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
Another important point, Said Mohsen, is that when the Iranians missed Qasim Soleimani, so many of them were neglectful of the role that he had in the security of Iran. And when you miss him, then you understand the role. Some part of it relates to the, we can say, the secretive actions that must be done. We know that in all the operations, there are some secretive agents who should not be known. Even nowadays, in the footage of Sardar Soleimani, which you see on the TV, the faces of some of the people are blurred, okay, in order to be hidden from the, we can say, the eyes of the people. But the case is that when now Soleimani is shown in the field, he is a man of Sharia. A person who does his salat on time and then continues his activities. And this made him very much, we can say, different from the other commanders nowadays active in the world on different fields. He was a man of Sharia, he was a religious man, he was a faithful man. At the same time, I think he was, strategically speaking, very much intelligent. What other features can you enumerate for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, what we can see in the Qasim Soleimani's life, according to what you just mentioned, the clips that are coming, we can see that in the school of thought of Qasim Soleimani, Qasim Soleimani was working for Islam. And his all, we can say, like, concerns were for Islam. No matter it is a Sunni or maybe a Shia or, as brother mentioned, like Christian or any other person, even in the for the humanity, he worked for the humanity. As Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam saved humanity. So he was the follower of Imam Hussein. And yes, it is true that his leader was Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and the mastermind is
the
leader.
Yes.
And he is one of the soldiers.
Yes.
Now, when we say one of the soldiers, how many soldiers that does the supreme leader have?
Mm-hmm.
There are many soldiers. So if one of the soldiers is like this, then the enemies should wait for the, obviously, the revenge that has been taken by the other soldiers.
Yes.
That's first thing. The other thing is what we can see in the characteristics that we can see in the school of thought of Qasim Soleimani was that this school has taught people how to raise voice against the word of force. The school has said to, like, this school was a school which raised his voice against against tyranny. The school raises voice against cruelty.
That's right.
The school raises voice against oppression and oppressors. And
yes.
the school raised his voice against dictatorship.
That's right.
So these are the things that the school was teaching people. And that's why the enemies were so much concerned, that because they were the oppressors, they were the cruel, they were the, we can say, they wanted their force word, the word of force,
to be distributed, to, the priest,
yeah, distributed
the,
amongst
right.
the people, or
yeah.
they should obey their word of force. The school of Qasim Soleimani, they came against it.
Right.
Why the Palestinians are resisting again, have the resistance against the, we can say, like the
Israelis,
the Israelis
That's
or
right.
the Zionist regime.
Yes.
Why Lebanese or the Hezbollah won the war? It's because they have learned this from Qasim Soleimani.
In Bahrain, Al Khalifa, that's right.
We see
okay.
that the Qasim Soleimani in 33-day war was there. He was
mm.
present there.
Yes.
So he taught them what is the word of Islam. And obviously, if I sum up everything, Qasim Soleimani and his school raised for justice.
Mm-hmm.
They raised for poor and the weak people.
That's all right.
Mustadhafin.
Yeah.
That's what Islam says.
Mm-hmm.
Islam is talking about the rights of the mustazafin, the
That's
poor,
right.
the needy people,
mm-hmm.
the weak people. And that was the difference. Even at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we can see like the leaders of the Arabs at that time, the mushrikeen, the polytheists, they were oppressing these people around them. And it was the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam who came up. He said, there is no caste. You should not differ amongst each other, or you're not a caste is not superior on another.
That's
there
right.
is no black and white. Everyone is equal.
Mm-hmm.
We can see this black. We can say like the
black movement. Yes.
The black movement in the America.
Yes.
Why is it happening?
Yeah, black lives
they're,
matter.
They've been oppressed.
Okay.
And why they raised their voice? Where did they learn?
Yes,
it was from Qasim Soleimani. We can see the posters of Qasim Soleimani amongst
yeah.
the many.
Everywhere.
We can say like these rallies or. You know, the protests that were happening even in the West.
What is important, that regardless of the political, we can say parties in Iran, when Qasim Soleimani was martyred, everybody from different political parties inside and outside had sent their messages of sadness and grief for the Iranian nation, okay? And this shows that he was really a man of Wahda,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yeah, sure.
So they could trust him. They could trust him and they could... Even when you see at the, we can say the pictures where the young people are over there in the burial ceremony, according to Rahbar, the burial ceremony and we can say commemoration was itself a great
mm-hmm.
sign for the enemies to show how much Qasim Soleimani was loved by the people of Iran across the nation. It shows that people from different classes of the societies with different levels of, we can say, wealth, and with different outfits are over there. We could see the women over there with not righteous hijab or something, you know. We could see the people which are young, you know, over there. This we can say teenagers are over there. The case is that such people and such personalities are still welcomed by the whole, we can say, nation of Iran, and they have their own specific
it's,
status.
It's because the justice that he was
yes.
following.
Yes, brother.
He raised for justice.
Yes.
And you know, it's in the fitrah.
Yes.
It's inside every person that they're looking for the justice.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking at injustice in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere we see oppression and injustice. Even if it is in regards to an Islamic country
yes.
or non-Islamic.
Yes.
Qasim Soleimani was a man whose wording, whose dealing with the people
mm.
was according to justice.
Yes.
And that's what he made him a hero for everyone.
That's right.
Even for these who were against the revolution. Maybe.
And also the Rahmani picture out
yeah.
of the Islam that he showed, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
He was really kind, you know, in all the pictures he's kind. Okay. Thank you much, Brother Ali Alevian and Thayed Mohsen Naqvi for presence in the program. Viewpoints. It was very kind of you, dear listeners. Thank you much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Kalab Islam page, also YouTube page, Kalab Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. اجتباك للخلود في دراك للقاك هل أعود أول
اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هل أعود أو وراك في سماك من الشهادات أنت حققت انتصار وانتظرت أنا لألحق بالمسار من دماك لعلاك يا شهيد اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هل أعود وراك في سماك من جديد
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The global campaign to return to Palestine and Muslim scholars were just two of the numerous Facebook pages to have their content blocked or restricted in the last month. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading Social Media Giants Ban Trump, But the Real Censorship is of Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details, please. In the wake of the Capitol Hill insurrection, Facebook and Twitter finally took a principled stand against President Donald Trump by suspending his accounts. While Trump lashed out at the tech giants, media analysts condoned the move, noting stronger moderation of his and other inflammatory posts are long overdue. Facebook, Twitter, and other social media behemoths have faced criticism over the years for allowing misinformation and dangerous incitement to run rampant on their platforms. Yet, while these companies seem to fail at controlling right-wing propaganda, they had no problem suppressing content on Palestine. According to Palestinian non-governmental organization Sada Social Center, Palestinian Facebook pages saw their contents reach dip by more than 50%. And in some cases, by more than 80%. Sada Social attributes the steep decline to coverage of Arab countries' normalization agreements with the Israeli regime. Most of the pages that brought complaints to us are followed by millions of users through Facebook, Sada Social wrote in their report. These pages actively participated in covering the issue of Arab normalization with Israeli regime occupation recently. The global campaign to return to Palestine and Muslim scholars were just two of the numerous Facebook pages to have their content blocked or restricted in the last month. When pressed for an explanation about the recent removals, a Facebook company spokesperson told Mint Press News, "We do our utmost to ensure that only content in violation of our community standards is removed. Where mistakes are made due to human or technical error, the content is restored." The Global Campaign for Return to Palestine page was unfortunately removed due to an error. It has now been restored. "We were not trying to limit anyone's ability to post or express themselves." In response to the increasing censorship, the Palestinian Content Protection Initiative, a group of media outlets, activists, and journalists working to defend Palestinian content online, called for a two-hour boycott of Facebook on January 9th. The administrations of social media websites have been pursuing, targeting, and restricting the publishing and access of Palestinian pages and accounts. And in full coordination with the Israeli regime occupation, the initiative said in a statement, "As a result, Palestinian media have been restricted and were unable to convey their national message." Facebook's targeting of Palestinian content isn't a new thing. The social media titan has a long history of working with the Zionist regime authorities to remove Palestinian information. Under the guise of hate speech, Facebook cracks down on content often related to certain keywords such as Hamas or Zionism. Alison Rammer, International Relations Manager at 7AMLE, the Arab Center for the Advancement of Social Media, explained, "A lot of times this is done through artificial intelligence, which the companies are really being pushed to use under the increasing pressure from governments and the public to respond to hate speech," Rammer said. "But it's not just automatic processes that are determining what's permitted on social media." According to 2020 7AMLE report, the Israeli regime has orchestrated a systematic campaign through Facebook to ensure content related to the Palestinian cause is removed. The Israeli regime Minister of Justice, Ayelet Shaked, stated that Facebook, Google, and YouTube are complying with up to 95% of Israeli regime requests to delete content that the regime says incites Palestinian violence. This shows a significant focus on Palestinian content and efforts to label Palestinian political speech as incitement to violence, 7AMLE wrote. These requests are done through the Ministry of Justice Cyber Unit, which was established in 2015. Even Facebook's own personnel appear to be in bed with the Israeli regime. Currently, Amy Palmer, the Zionist regime's former Justice Ministry Director General, sits on Facebook and Instagram's Oversight Board, a committee responsible for content moderation. Additionally, governmental and non-governmental organizations are urging citizens to report Palestinian content. Several of these organizations dubbed Go NGOs, that is, government-operated NGOs, are working to conflate criticism of the Zionist regime and anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and hate speech, and have designed strategies to manipulate social media algorithms with the support of online trolls, 7AMLE wrote. These efforts not only remove Palestinian content, but elevate smear campaigns against Palestinians. As Facebook works diligently to remove white supremacist content, Ramer acknowledged that it leaves hate speech directed toward Palestinians on its site. 7 Amle has documented hate speech directed toward Palestinians in Hebrew, which we have seen left online for many years. While legitimate political speech critical of Israeli regime is being flagged as hate speech and censored, Ramer said. We know that the Israeli regime and government-supporting NGOs are pushing for tech companies to adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, which is leading to increasing censorship of Palestinians and human rights defenders. According to Ramer, pressure from the Israeli regime lobby is a motivating factor in restricting Palestinian content. There is pressure on Facebook to extend the definition of anti-Semitism, and we know that the intention of this is to censor those critical of the Zionist regime, Palestinians and human rights supporters. And this, obviously, can have a large impact on the development of many other tech companies' policies, Ramer said. Facebook is the most popular social media platform for Palestinians, but it's not the only one restricting their content. TikTok recently removed the account belonging to Palestinian news organization Quds News Network. The account manager, Hamza Al-Shabaki, said it was deleted for sharing 1,200 posts about Arab countries' normalization with the Zionist regime. TikTok has since reinstated the account, claiming a violation error led to account's removal. This isn't QAnon's first experience with social media censorship, however. In 2019, the news outlet had 4 of its Twitter accounts deactivated without warning. QAnon editors also had their personal Facebook accounts suspended in 2016, reportedly by mistake. Other Palestinian media sources have also had their Twitter and Facebook accounts removed over the years. YouTube has been accused of violating Palestinian digital rights as well. Research from 7 Amle details that video sharing platform uses hyper-surveillance tactics referred to as locative discrimination to monitor content coming from Palestine. According to their findings, Palestinian YouTube user Ahmad conducted an online experiment to see if the removal of his content was due to his location. I sent the same video which has been deleted from my YouTube account to my friend's YouTube account in Europe, and YouTube was fine with the video being published from a European country. This simple test showed that the content that's being uploaded in the Palestinian territories is being treated differently than the content uploaded by Western countries, 7 Amle Ramer said. These policies are discriminatory and overly surviving and censoring Palestinians. Ramer emphasized that tech companies should not be the decision makers regarding freedom of expression. Yet, because they control these communication channels, they are ultimately tasked with monitoring what is shared. And the Israeli regime is taking full advantage of that. The Zionist regime is using this for its political aim to silence Palestinians. They are using hate speech as a political tool, Ramer said, clarifying that what's happening not only blacks out Palestinians' issues, but the global conversation on human rights as a whole. This won't just silence Palestinians, but it will silence human rights defenders, and it will show their governments how to use hate speech to silence and censor people.